Welcome to the Florida Roundup. It's the statewide edition this hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa is off this week. 3 weeks ago, students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School and their supporters laid down in the aisles of a Publix store in Coral Springs, near where the school shooting happened back in February. It was a die-in protest for 12 minutes over the grocery store's financial support of Adam Putnam, who's running for governor. Putnam has called himself a proud NRA sellout. Just before the students lay down, Publix announced it would stop making political contributions. Now, another massive corporate presence in Florida may find itself the target of a similar protest in the days and weeks ahead. A group co-founded by survivors of the Parkland shooting is planning to stage a die-in at Disney. The company has contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to Putnam's political action committee, including donations since the February school shooting. Disney could become the latest company to face pressure over its political contributions in Florida to the gubernatorial hopeful Putnam and his position on guns. So this is where we will start the statewide edition this hour. What do you think of Disney's political money operating in Florida politics? Would you support a die-in protest of Disney and its use of its financial resources in Sunshine State politics? What did you make of the about-face by Publix to stop corporate political donations? Phones are open now, 305-995-1800, all across the peninsula and the panhandle, 305-995-1800. Gray Rohr is along with us now, Orlando Sentinel reporter who covers the state capitol. He is with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Gray, nice to have you on the program. Who's behind the threat of this potential die-in for Disney?
Well, it's a group called National Die-In. It was co-founded by survivors of the Parkland shooting. And it sort of started in a online chat group with other like-minded individuals mm-hmm. around the country. And they, the attention that was brought to Publix and their donations, you know, they're not the only company that's been donating to Putnam's campaign, and they saw how much Disney's been donating and wanted to do something similar.
I want to talk to you about the Disney political donations in a minute here, but a little bit more on this group. What do we know about plans for this die-in protest against Disney? Is there a schedule for it? Do we know when and where?
Yeah, they're still pretty vague at this point. They said that they wanted to do it at a Disney headquarters or a theme park in Orlando. So that's still up in the air. The time frame would be sometime this month. You get the feeling that that might be subject to change, but that's the general idea.
When they talk about a Disney headquarters, and they mean something in a Disney corporate headquarters, of course, is not in the state of Florida, but this group is going to focus its efforts on Disney properties in the state of Florida. Is that fair to say?
That's correct.
Okay. So talk to us about the Disney political contributions, specifically this year to Adam Putnam.
Well, specifically this year, they've given $300,000 to Putnam's political committee, Florida Grown, since the Parkland shooting happened on February 14th. Previous to that, they've given about $500,000 or more to that political committee.
Mm-hmm. So about $800,000 Disney corporate dollars, political action committee for Adam Putnam in the last, about 3.5 years or so?
It actually goes back to 2015, so yeah, that's about right. But it goes back beyond the past election cycle. But ever since he's been gearing up for the gubernatorial campaign.
Now, in 2017, you reported and asked for a statement from Disney. In 2017, Disney said, "quote We support candidates who understand issues important to our company and demonstrate strong support for business and tourism." In Florida, clearly no different than any other company operating in the state of Florida that has the wherewithal to make political contributions, right?
Right, and they've given to politicians that can help them. They've given to Democrats in the past. They give to Democrats out in California that are in power out there. So it's not. This is by no means unusual for them.
No. I suppose what is unusual, of course, are the voices and the kinds of protests that we're now seeing that have been sparked by the Parkland school massacre and frankly, the relative success that this protest had 3 weeks ago with Publix and its political contributions as the grocery store chain based just outside of Orlando decided to stop making political contributions. More on that with Gray Rohr of the Orlando Sentinel and your phone calls, 305-995-1800. Do you support these kinds of protests against corporate political donors in the Sunshine State? We'll begin in South Florida, in South Miami, as a matter of fact. Connor is with us. Connor, go ahead. You're on the radio. Your thoughts.
How's it going? Yeah, I just think that's not technically the right approach. I'm fully in support of the Parkland students and what they're trying to do. But I'm a big believer that if you want to stand up for something, that you should go out and vote, and that should be how you show your opinion. And I don't think that the corporation should really come under scrutiny like that, because they obviously support Putnam for many, many other reasons besides his views on guns.
Connor, we got it. Thanks so much for your perspective. Greg, talk to us a little bit about this kind of single issue protest. Obviously, a very important issue, guns and school safety here. But to Connor's point, voters have to kind of, you know, consider the whole portfolio of issues that a candidate is going to represent. And certainly a business operating in the state of Florida has to do the same.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, Disney operates on a bunch of different levels as far as, you know, what they want to get out of different pieces of legislation and stuff like that. Guns aren't very high up on them. I mean, if you go back to 2008, they were actually opposed to, I believe that was the year, a bill that would have allowed to workers to bring guns, leave them in their car as they went to work. Mm-hmm. And that was a big issue for them. So they're not, they're on board with the Adam Putnam agenda, I would say, rather than the NRA agenda.
Yeah. I mean, you think about the issues that intersect Disney's business in the state of Florida. Obviously, you think about land issue, zoning, real estate, water management, even workers' comp, employee relations, all of those kinds of things certainly would impact Disney and its business operations here. Disney is not, in my estimation, in my memory, and Greg, remind me if I'm wrong, has really been vocal when it comes to firearms, the Second Amendment, or gun rights, and even concealed weapon laws, or even stand your ground kind of legislation, criminal justice kind of issues.
No, that's correct. I mean, they are about things that will affect their bottom line, and you know, guns for the most part just doesn't pop up on that radar screen.
305-995-1800 across the state of Florida. Your thoughts here on this potential die-in protest that Parkland students and their supporters are planning against Disney, possibly sometime this month, perhaps in the next few weeks. Cooper City in Broward County. Ivana is on line three. Ivana, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Just a comment. I do support the protest. I think that this is democracy. It's a democratic protest and peaceful, and they do have a right to express what they feel about it. Definitely vote is very important. It's not only a right, but it's a duty. But also, you know, protesting peacefully is also a right, and we should exercise it.
Ivana, appreciate your thoughts on that as well. Let's stay in Broward County. Tamarack and Sarah on line four. Sarah, you're on the radio. Your thoughts?
Yes. Ivana had said, this is a peaceful protest that the students want to do. And I guess I feel that as much as I love Disney, it is hurtful to see somebody, a company that is supposed to be for kids and families and so forth, have somebody say, well, yes, I support the NRA, which is very big on guns and so forth, to say, well, yeah, you know, it's a turf war.
Sure. To be clear, Sarah, I think Disney is, with its money, saying it supports a particular candidate. The candidate then, in this case, Adam Putnam, is the one who has declared himself a proud NRA sellout. So
right.
I guess by extension, you're making that connection.
Yes, I am.
Gotcha. Does it change your opinion of Disney? You mentioned that you were a Disney fan.
Not necessarily. It doesn't, but it just, well, maybe in some aspects it does. but it just hurts deep down inside, you know, what, per se. So, but yes, in some aspects it does.
Sarah in Tamarack, thanks for your phone call. 305-995-1800. Continuing our conversation with Gray Rohr, reporter at the Orlando Sentinel, covering Florida's legislature and politics in the race for governor. He's with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Gray, what has been the Ag Commissioner Adam Putnam's response to this possibility of having a political donor targeted like this? Did he respond at all to the public's die-in as well?
To the extent, the answer is he just wanted to talk about it as little as possible. He's defended the companies, doesn't think that they should be subject to these sorts of protests just for backing him, sort of chalks it up all to politics. That's pretty much his line on it.
And the lessons from the public protest. This was a very public protest of a beloved company in the state of Florida, a company that I think a lot of Floridians are very proud of. It consistently ranks as one of the best companies to work for in different kinds of polls. And for Publix to be targeted with the kind of protest with the with teenagers and adults laying down in the aisle of this Coral Springs Publix for 12 minutes 3 weeks ago, even before that happened, the company made its about face. What have we come to understand about that? What are the lessons from that?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but these are iconic Florida companies and brands. And even though, you know, large segments of the public might side with them and doesn't think they should be subjected to these protests either, these companies aren't in the business of alienating any sector of the
right.
public. They want everyone to come to their park, to their grocery store. So, it's one lesson was that from the public's episode was that it was on a certain level effective.
Certainly got the company to change its policy, to change its stated policy, right?
Yes, and we'll see how long the suspension of political giving lasts, but it was pretty remarkable that they came out and said that because they've donated to a bunch of people pretty much every cycle.
Yeah, that's the way politics happens, not just in Florida, but, of course, the United States, no doubt about it. But talk to us, Gray. You're a veteran political reporter. Your comment right there caught my ear. We'll see how long it lasts. Tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Well, there's different ways of giving in politics. They said they suspended all political giving.
Corporate giving, I think, is what they said, right? Suspended corporate giving.
Okay.
If memory serves right.
Okay. I mean, if they continue, I doubt they'll continue to give directly to campaigns anymore, but will they give to an industry committee that then gives to other campaigns?
And what about executives and board of directors and you know, people who are high up on the food chain, pun intended, when it comes to a company like Publix, but elsewhere? It doesn't affect their ability to personally give.
Sure. And does it last just for this cycle, or does it continue after some of the or does it continue to subside after the subsides a little bit? If it does or doesn't, will that moratorium continue?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if it continues beyond the primary season into the general election, when things get much more expensive when it comes to statewide advertising in some of these big races. We're with Gray Rohr, political reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, talking about the possibility of a student-led protest, a die-in protest against Disney, very similar to what the Parkland students organized against Publix 3 weeks ago. Your phone calls, 305-995-1800. In Miami, Richard on line 4. Go ahead, Richard. Your thoughts.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say, I support the Parkland students, but I think if a company is going to engage in political advocacy via financial contribution, they're buying the whole package. They're not just buying their narrow interest. So if they, be it Disney or Publix or whatever, they give money to Putnam for whatever suits their needs, but then Putnam has other political positions that are abhorrent, yeah. Well, you know, he comes with everything. He doesn't, they're not full trying to put him into office.
Yeah.
You know, it affects all of us in different ways, and particularly Disney, which is supposed to be a family-oriented, you know, corporation, you know, all this stuff. I mean, for them to be giving money to Putnam, that's on the record for being like a staunch NRA supporter, I mean, you know, it's not good enough. I mean, yeah, we exercise our rights via the ballot box, but these days, I mean, we can't even... Our speech is limited compared to the billions of dollars that corporations pour into political campaigns every day.
And I think your part, Richard, about buying the whole candidate, the whole package, that goes for voters as well. You can't just kind of slice off a portion of your vote for the portion of a candidate's positions that you support. When you cast your vote, it's kind of all or nothing. That support goes that way.
Absolutely. But if you take, for instance, you know, the Publix protest, the highest profile was given to the gun issue when it came to Putnam. But, you know, aside from that, you know, let's not forget that Publix was supporting Putnam because he, you know, he changed the rules so that health and safety violations in public stores wouldn't be reported as such.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was involved in this, he sold land for five times its value to the state of Florida, and then he got his family to use it for grazing.
Yep.
You know, so there's a whole variety of issues with
absolutely, Richard. We want to hear more of those variety. We got some other callers on the line. Richard, Miami, thanks for your thoughts. North Lauderdale, Stephen, you are now on the radio. Go ahead, Stephen.
Oh yes, thank you for accepting my call. I've been listening intently to everybody's point of view here, and I think my main concern is with negating a portion of the people that have that believe in the NRA. Ironically, I pull up here to my home, and the gentleman next door, be quiet, please. The gentleman next door is actually mowing his lawn with an NRA hat on.
Hmm.
And I kind of walked over there, and pardon me, and we listened to your conversation here, and the you know, we both made our comments, but I think, you know, one of the main things that bothered me is,
Stephen, I got to interrupt here. I got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
But I just want to say, I just don't believe that these kids are doing anything substantial to help. I think if you grow up and learn to vote, and the parents should really be controlling those children.
All right,
you know?
Stephen, we got that. Thank you for your input there. Stephen in North Lauderdale as well. Appreciate that. Gray Rohr, just 20 seconds. Any other Florida companies that could become targets of this group, do you know of?
There's a long list of companies, but the ones that come to mind are some of the main utility companies, mm-hmm. FPL.
Yeah.
You know, it remains to be seen how far this is going to go and what other companies this could or will go to.
We're going
to
leave it there. Greg Rohr. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, Statewide Edition Hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa is off this week. Thanks for listening. It was 2 years ago this week, Omar Mateen walked into Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, and shot and killed 49 people. Jerry Reeland was on vacation that night, but he was called in for a 16-hour shift with the Orlando Police Department. He was inside the nightclub for several hours after the shooting ended, but with the victims' bodies remaining. He's among the first responders who were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
It's exhausting, physically and mentally, but then there's the moments that you can't control. The images or flashbacks or the nightmares that you don't even know about, and your wife tells you the next day you were screaming or twitching all night. And then you do have their nightmares that wake you up, and the nightmares that seem unrelated that wake you up. The sleep issues, hiding from your kids so that they're not traumatized by your rage or depression, which gives them a sense of insecurity, which isn't good.
Reeland's battle with PTSD and his battle to secure a paycheck from his police department after Pulse are part of the lasting
damage of the massacre. WMFE's Abe Abaraya chronicles the stories in a special report released this week. Five first responders to the Pulse massacre, one diagnosis, PTSD. Abe joins us from our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Abe, how is Jerry doing now?
Well, at this point, Jerry Reelin has actually gone through the disability pension process. So he's been able to get approximately 80% of his pay pretty much in perpetuity from here on out. So he'd be able to continue getting a paycheck. The other factor in that, though, is that his health insurance costs at about $1,700 a month are not included in that pension. And that's part of the reason why he's still continuing in a lawsuit against the city of Orlando and the Orlando Police Department.
Tell us his story a little bit in terms of after that awful overnight shift, after that awful 16-hour shift, the day of the Pulse shooting. How did he come to the diagnosis of PTSD, and what was that process like for him?
So it started about 2 weeks after. The symptoms began pretty much right away. And I should mention, too, when it comes to post-traumatic stress disorder in particular, you know, these reactions to a traumatic experience are considered, you know, essentially normal. When you go through something, you know, like this, that you are going to have trouble sleeping, that you might have nightmares, you know, you might be, you know, a little bit more on edge, thinking about it constantly. You know, these are considered a normal reaction. And where it becomes a disorder is where it starts to affect your functioning. And if it continues for, you know, month, 2 months, or in this case, 2 years. So with Jerry, it was about 2 weeks after he'd been having trouble going to work. At one point, he'd passed out in his patrol car. And so, you know, he'd done a couple times previously in his career, he basically filed a notice, a first report of injury, basically saying, I was hurt on the job. In this case, it wasn't for, you know, I pulled my back or cracked my knee. It was, I have post-traumatic stress disorder.
He recognized it.
He recognized that there was something wrong. And so he went into a center care that's contracted with the city of Orlando. And, you know, the doctor on there diagnosed him with acute post-traumatic stress disorder, basically wrote that it was bad enough that he was not able to work on shift anymore, even at a desk job.
Allison Clark is also with us in Orlando. She's an Orlando police officer who responded to the Pulse shooting. She also worked as an off-duty security officer at Pulse previous to the massacre. Allison, thank you for your time and sharing your story with us here today.
Absolutely.
Proud to be here. Tell us your process for your diagnosis for PTSD.
I was an initial responder the night of the Pulse massacre, and the symptoms started developing right away. And probably about 2 months after the incident, my wife Kate, who is also an Orlando police officer, recommended I go to counseling because of the symptoms I was displaying: moodiness, no patience, anxiety. So I started seeing counselor through our EAP program.
Employee assistance program at the department, yeah.
Yes. Okay. So I started seeing a counselor routinely to work through my PTS-related issues from Pulse through EAP until about December of that year.
And what about lately? What about this year?
Pretty much gotten through my anxiety issues with Pulse. I was functioning as an officer. I hadn't come off the road. I was still working in law enforcement, still being a day shift patrol officer at that point. About the following month in January of 2017, I was a member of Deborah Clayton's squad.
Yeah.
And I was with her the day she was killed in the line of duty. And that created some different PTSD issues for me, to include extreme hypervigilance.
Officer Clayton, Lieutenant Clayton, was a police lieutenant in Orlando who had responded to a call. She was shot in the line of duty, and you responded to that call. Officer Clayton, Lieutenant Clayton, passed away.
Yes, I was with her in the parking lot that morning that she passed. I was a member of her squad, and immediately after her passing, my PTSD issues started resurfacing, and then on top of it, some additional anxiety and hypervigilance issues. I started seeing counselor again, and went, after about 4 months, I went to see a psychiatrist through my own private insurance, and saw a psychiatrist and was put on Prozac to help with my anxiety issues because it started affecting the way I responded to calls when I was at work.
I want to talk more, Allison, with you about how Pulse and the PTSD that came from Pulse, as well as this shooting of Lieutenant Clayton, how that's affected your law enforcement career. 305-995-1800 is our phone number here, talking 2 years after the Pulse massacre and the reporting about five first responders to the Pulse massacre, one diagnosis, PTSD. Abe Abaraya is with us, healthcare reporter with our partner station WMFE. Allison Clark also with us, an Orlando police officer who responded to Pulse. Abe, how common are these stories that you've reported with these five first responders? Officer Reeland's story that we mentioned earlier, Officer Clark's story that we're hearing here in real time. How do these compare with other first responders to Pulse?
Well, there's a couple things. You know, when it comes to the Pulse shooting in particular, there were 26 first responders who have gone through the University of Central Florida's Resource Clinic. And that's a clinic that was originally developed for combat veterans overseas to get, you know, basically an intense three-week program for post-traumatic stress disorder. After Pulse, they started seeing first responders. And so they've seen 26 first responders to the Pulse nightclub shooting. So that's, they've evaluated them or treated them. And it could be that, you know, a number of them may have been seen for a, not necessarily PTSD, but a different diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Some of them could have gone in, got evaluated, and left. So we don't know for certain. But there are, and I have certainly talked to other first responders to Pulse that don't want to come out publicly because of, you know, various reasons why they don't want to come out.
Sure.
So there are more first responders to that incident. But what I will say to that, though, is, you know, we've been doing the survey at ProPublica.org/PTSD, where we've been collecting stories from across the country with this. And the majority of the stories we are getting are not from major incidents like Pulse or Las Vegas. They're the more routine calls, if you can call them that, that sort of develop cumulatively over time. And so, you know, a first responder might, you know, see 10 car accidents in a career, and the 11th one where, you know, it's a child, and the child is wearing something that reminds them of their kid, and that's the point where it starts to become a disorder. So we are seeing more of that, and that's also reflected in the UCF numbers. They've seen 26 responders to Pulse, but
University
they've seen...
University of Central Florida, right?
University of Central Florida, this resource clinic, they've seen 26 responders to Pulse and another 100 since then dealing with other issues. So I think when you are thinking about PTSD and first responders, it's important to know that these big incidents get a lot of attention for it, and that's certainly the reason why I started, but it's a lot more of a career issue going forward for a lot of these officers.
And Officer Clark, Allison Clark with us. Talk to us about that, because as you quickly described your story to us, first of all, thank you for sharing it publicly. You talk about the your PTSD diagnosis and the treatment post-Pulse. And then is it fair to call it a relapse because of this, the lieutenant who you worked with was shot and killed in the line of duty with you there?
Well, I think I'm probably an interesting case study. I've been a patrol officer and an officer with OPD going on almost 15 years. 13 of it was spent on midnight shift patrol, meaning I was an initial responder, calls for service, and I was a training officer, too, for 11 years. So I worked in probably one of the most violent parts of Orlando, and over my course of my career in patrol on midnights, it did start to wear on me probably a few months before Pulse actually happened.
How did that manifest itself, officer? How did you, I mean, in hindsight, certainly, but how did you feel that?
Well, once I started getting treatment right after Pulse, I started doing a lot of my own research on the effects of PTSD cumulatively, and I realized several months before Pulse, I was involved in a situation where I nearly shot somebody who came very close to stabbing me, and luckily it was the situation was handled appropriately and everybody was safe. But it was that night I went to my lieutenant and started talking to him about putting in a transfer to day shift or going to another unit outside of patrol, because I felt I started feeling the effects of how many years I had spent on the road on midnights and realized it was time for a change. So I'd put in for day shift, and when Pulse happened, my day shift transfer was actually on the list waiting. Hmm. And then I was transferred to Lieutenant Deborah Clayton's squad in September of 2016.
Yeah.
And then she was killed in the line of duty January 2017. I continued doing counseling on my own up until February of this year, when I found myself in probably the first extreme high stress situation I had been in since Deborah was killed. And it was at that point on February 20th, where I was responding with another officer to a situation, and the subject apparently was trying to bait us into suicide by cop, and I had to hold him at gunpoint.
Meaning the suspect was essentially trying to encourage you to shoot him or her.
Yes, he was. So I had to hold him at gunpoint until other squad members showed up to put him in handcuffs. But it was during that situation where my hypervigilance and my anxiety really kicked in at a high level. And once we got that suspect into custody, I ended up having an extreme panic attack. And as I walked towards my patrol car, in my head, I knew that was probably going to be my very last call as a patrol officer. I can't do it anymore.
And so how has this diagnosis, this path that you've been on, Officer Clark, how has it affected your law enforcement career?
It makes me sad to think that I cannot be a patrol officer and be that officer that shows up to people's houses and solves problems, because that's probably my favorite part of my job. I love being a police officer, and I can still work in law enforcement. There's a lot of other things I can do without having to get into a patrol car and be the first one to respond to a call. You know, there's detective work that can be done. We have an intel unit. We have a unit out at the airport. That's probably where I'm going to end up going, is out to the airport when I'm ready. So as far as staying in law enforcement, I can do that. It's just, it's like a early retirement. I wasn't really ready 5 years short of my actual retirement to turn in my patrol car and not have those cool red and blue lights and running the calls and helping people immediately. But three weeks before the incident in February, I had actually applied to the UCF Restores program in order to get some additional help with the PTS. And amazingly, that day, that afternoon, they had called me and told me I was accepted into the program.
Amazing. Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio. Talking with Allison Clark, a member of the Orlando Police Department who responded to the Pulse massacre 2 years ago. WMFE's healthcare reporter Abe Abaraya has chronicled the stories of Allison and other first responders in a special report published this week. 5 first responders to the Pulse massacre, 1 diagnosis, PTSD. Allison, I want you to talk a little bit about what Abe mentioned to us a few moments ago, which is maybe a broader recognition of the PTSD situation and reality for first responders, while high-profile situations like Pulse certainly bring the spotlight of media attention, and rightfully so. The cumulative effect, is that being more recognized, do you think, in the troops with policemen and women?
I believe it will be. I believe there's some studies that are now beginning. But now that I think back on my first year as an officer, I remember sitting at a table at my patrol unit on my patrol squad and looking at the officers that had about 12, 13 years on, and thinking they were really, you know, salty and really negative about the job, and thinking to myself, God, I'm never going to be that way. Well, I started acting like that, and I think that's a result of the cumulative PTS.
Abe, this year, Florida lawmakers passed a new law expanding worker compensation benefits to cover PTSD for first responders. It doesn't go into effect until October 1st of this year. What do you think it'll mean? What could it mean for future law enforcement, first responders, and PTSD?
Well, there's a couple things about that. One, it does have a training requirement embedded in the law for departments to, you know, start doing some education and training dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental injuries, as far as, you know, for police officers and first responders. Another thing that the law has done, sort of, you know, maybe a unintended consequence, Florida has had workers' compensation benefits for PTSD, but only medical coverage, so you could get, you know, psychiatric visits or therapy visits covered. So this law, you know, all the media attention it's garnered has actually gotten more responders to realize, oh, well, there was something else that existed, you know, before, you know, this law kicks into effect. The law that starts in October, it doesn't include everyone. Dispatchers in particular are not going to be, you know, able to respond based on the list of criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. Same with corrections officers. And, you know, also it has a list of events that qualify you, and you have to go, you know, it's, you know, adult suicide, child suicide, or child death. You know, it's events like that that can qualify you for a diagnosis from a psychiatrist of post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's very specific. So in a way, that the law that's kicking in is a recognition of, you know, the impact of major events like Parkland, like Pulse, but it's not quite recognizing some of the more cumulative effects that might draw into a career where, you know, you might have something that kicks in, and, you know, a lot of PTSD kicks in months or years after, you know, an event. So, you know, there's a couple things that maybe the law might end up being tweaked about.
And as Allison bears witness to, it can, you know, return with another instance, another situation that can spark that as well. Abe, we really appreciate the reporting that you've shared with us here. Abe Abaraya, healthcare reporter at our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Special report out this week, 5 first responders to the Pulse Massacre, 1 diagnosis, PTSD. And Allison, thank you so much for sharing your story with our public radio listeners as well. Allison Clark, an Orlando police officer who responded to the Pulse Massacre 2 years ago. Thank you for your time. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. Thanks again for listening to public radio in Florida. I'm Tom Hudson here in Miami. Melissa is off today. So let's tackle the week that was in Sunshine State politics. A busy week again. The top Republican running for governor found himself defending the agency he currently runs. Agriculture Secretary Adam Putnam says public safety was not put at risk, even though his department did not review background checks for concealed weapons permits for more than a year.
If any of the 291 had committed a crime while in possession of that CWL, we would have been made aware of that, because depending on the crime, they would have had to have that revoked.
An employee in the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services did not have access to an FBI crime database because she couldn't log in. What do you make about this story? 305-995-1800 all across the peninsula and the panhandle. Also this week in Florida politics, a billionaire who just entered the race to become governor says he'll spend whatever it takes to get elected. Jeff Green is his name. He filed paperwork to run as a Democrat in the governor's race. He didn't hold a news conference or tour the state on a bus or a plane campaign style when he made his announcement. He did tell the Associated Press this week, though, that he'll spend whatever it takes, in his words, $100 million, $50 million, $200 million, to, quote, make sure that our message is heard. 305-995-1800. Politics in the week that was. Patricia Mazzei is the Miami bureau chief for the New York Times. She joins us via Skype. Once we get a hold of Patricia via Skype, we will get there. It was quite a week for politics here in the Sunshine State. We're still in the primary season, yes, but as the temperatures heat up, so does the politicking, and so do the issues as it comes to voters and trying to gather support. On Saturday and on Monday, over the course of just 3 days, the four Democratic gubernatorial candidates met for 2 different forums. Lots of issues and personal characteristics were debated amongst those four. And we also saw this week the Spanish language ads debuting from Governor Scott and Senator Bill Nelson in their contest for the U.S. Senate. Patty Mazzei, Miami bureau chief for the New York Times, now with us via Skype. Patty, always great to have you on here. Let's start with Adam Putnam. It was a week ago where this story from the Tampa Bay Times came out that the state of Florida and his agency, the Agriculture Commission, had not reviewed background checks for folks that were applying for concealed weapons permits. Walk us through specifically what the story was, what his agency did not do.
Well, at first it sounded like his agency had not run background checks for more than a year on concealed weapon permit applications because an employee of the of his office had lost their login, their ability to log into one particular database to check people's backgrounds. Now, it later turned out that it was that his office was not reviewing applications that had been flagged. So it wasn't that background checks weren't conducted at all. It was out of these thousands of applications, a few hundred had been flagged and they were not reviewed as required. And as a result, 291 concealed weapon permits that had been issued had to be revoked once they realized that they had made a mistake. Now, the big question here, other than, you know, not following the existing law over something as minor as not being able to log in, is that this was discovered by another employee of the agency, and the employee was fired, the original employee, and there was an IG report about it, and at no point did Commissioner Putnam talk about it.
Right.
Had he revealed it in due course as part of his office's business and said, you know, we found a problem and this is how we handled it, it might not have become a campaign issue. But now more people are paying attention, and now he's having to defend himself, and we can't even, you know, we have to take him at his word for some of this because, as you know, Tom, it's not public record to check who has concealed weapons permits. So we have asked his office, you know, how do you know that none of these people who got these permits have committed any crimes, you know, before they were revoked, the 291 permits? And they say, well, none of them have been flagged in the state system, and they would be flagged if a crime had been committed after the fact. But we sort of have to take their word for it.
Yeah,
you know?
The disclosure question here, as you know, one of the four cabinet members in the state of Florida, one of the leading government officials who is responsible for gun permits, in this case, concealed weapons permits, whose office was stymied by a missing password or missing username for more than a year. This internal investigation report happens, lands on his desk. He says he took action. But it took months before, apparently, even Governor Scott may have known about this. Is that right, Patty?
Well, and Governor Scott was very quick after the story came out when he was finally asked about it to just sort of be like, oh, we didn't know about this.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's one of those things that you could see coming out in a TV ad against Adam Putnam. Now, his office has again said, you know, it was not every single permit that came in. This wasn't an application to buy a weapon. It was an application.
Patty, your Skype connection is getting a little bit...
Weapon permit. But, you know, it's one of those things... I'm sorry?
Your Skype connection's getting a little iffy.
Hello?
Here. We're gonna connect on the phone here, Patty. So just give us a moment. We'll connect with you on the phone.
Okay.
Patty Mazzei, with the bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll give her a call on her cell number to get a better connection there. But in the meantime, your phone calls at 305-995-1800. Florida Politics. Wilton Manners is up first. That is in South Florida. And Karen is on line one. Karen, thanks for calling in. Your thoughts today.
First of all, I wanted to thank you for talking about all of the topics that you've discussed today, because as my opinion is, they're all related. You know, Pulse was located approximately 25 miles from the entrance to Walt Disney World. And Disney, you know, mm-hmm. continues to make donations to the self-proclaimed, you know, the voluntarily proclaimed proud NRA sellout. And then the permits that were not checked happened during the time of Pulse. And because of the gun violence, including at Pulse, we now have first responders who, you know, have PTSD claims that we as taxpayers now have to pay the disability payments. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, Publix and Disney need to make amends for the donations that they've made. It's not enough to stop, you know, giving the money to Putnam. They need to give equal money to Moms Demand Action, and they need to give money to the victims' funds. And this is what we are demanding of them.
Karen, is this shaping your vote? Is this the singular voting issue for you that you'll take into the ballot box in the primary in August in the general?
There is no more important issue. if you are a parent of a public school child, if you are somebody who goes to the movies, who goes to concerts, who goes to Disney, there is not one more important issue than the gun violence here in the state of Florida. And it is the most important.
Gotcha. Karen, lots of passion there from Wilton Manors today here on the Florida Roundup. Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. 305-995-1800. Politics this week in the Sunshine State. We'll rejoin Patty Mazzei with the New York Times, based in Miami, coming up in just a matter of moments. West Palm Beach is up next, though. Nora is on line four. Nora, go ahead. Your thoughts.
Well, my thoughts are this is absolutely ludicrous that not only did she not think that maybe she should get this background check password so she could check this out, but it's absolutely horrifying that these were flagged. That means that there was already something going on with them, and perhaps they should not be getting these permits. So the lack of checking them is ridiculous. The lack of her doing her job and sitting there for a year going, don't know what to do. We all have to stand up, and we all have to make our voice be heard. I went to Washington in March just for this reason, and I will make sure everything I do this moment forward and that I've already been working on is to help get the word out, get the vote out, and make sure that these people that don't do their job are voted out.
Nora, we got it from West Palm Beach. Thanks for checking in with us here on the Florida Roundup. Patty Mazzei back with us from the New York Times. Patty, a couple of callers there who clearly are voting on the gun issue. How could this affect Adam Putnam, though, in the primary against Ron DeSantis? As Florida, we have to remind ourselves, a closed primary system. If you're not registered for Republican, you're not going to be able to go into the ballot box in late August and make a selection for the Republican to ultimately run in the general election.
Well, we haven't really heard a lot of state Republicans weigh in on this. And DeSantis' campaign was pretty quiet while the Putnam story was playing out, which is something campaigns do when they sense that their opponent is getting some heat. And I think the only thing they said was at some point that they thought he would have found out earlier if he had been more on top of his office than on his next campaign, right? That was their political jab at him. What was interesting was at the debate this week of the Democrats, four of the Democrats running for governor, they didn't mention DeSantis. They mentioned Putnam, which means the Democrats see Putnam as their as the front runner and their likely opponent, even though they say they would rather run against DeSantis, right? Because he's more conservative. And so it's interesting that they wouldn't bring up DeSantis at all, and instead they still see Putnam as their biggest target.
Patty, we're going to squeeze in one more call here. Chris in Hollywood in South Florida. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the radio. Time is tight here. Make your point, please.
Sure. I'm an officer in South Florida, and I just thought the assertion from the state that nothing has popped up in their system in reference to a felon with a that got his CCW permit by mistake is somehow an indication that it hasn't happened. When we make an arrest for a felony, unless the person is physically in possession of a CCW permit at the time of the arrest, we have no reason to check the state system to see if they have one that needs to be revoked. So if there's an armed robbery today and we make an arrest 2 days from now and he's not in possession of a CCW at the time, there's no reason why we would ever run him through the state system to see if he has one.
You wouldn't even check to see if there's one.
No, there'd be no reason to.
Yeah.
So the assertion that nothing has popped up in the system is an indication that none of these people that got their permit is... It's ludicrous.
Chris, we got to leave it there. Appreciate your time today. Chris from Hollywood. Patty Mazzei with the New York Times Miami Bureau Chief. Sorry about the connectivity problems, Patty, but thanks for your time and sharing your reporting with us here on the Florida Roundup as well. That is our program. It is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Kevin Mershart is the producer. Jason Zapka is our technical director. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Lebos at aaronlebos.com. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, and thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.